This is KPFT in Houston. I'm Wally James. Our guest tonight is Sean Richmond. He's author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. He's the program director of the School of Labor Studies at Sunny Empire State College. His writing has been published in the American Prospect, In These Times, the New York Daily News, and the New York Times. He joins us by phone. Sean, welcome to the Progressive Forum.
Thanks for having me.
Well, one of the things that's been in the news is Kroger. They gave this hero's bonus to their workers working during the pandemic, and now they're saying they're taking it back. Yeah.
Yeah.
Their union's not too happy about that. I mean, people are still exposed. They're risking their lives. And can you give us your thoughts on this?
Pretty outrageous. Fortunately, the workers at Kroger mostly have a union, so they have, say, at the table. That is an especially cheapo unionized employer to be trying to pull it back. What I've seen in terms of employers' response to COVID is that the sort of the legacy unionized employers, so places where there's been a union for decades and decades, have actually been pretty reasonable. The phone company here in New York, Verizon, who's really just a real penny pincher under normal circumstances, when this thing came down, they came to the union with a very reasonable telework plan. They've been working with the union on personal protective gear. That speaks to the power of a union and the power of a mature collective bargaining relationship. And unfortunately, the vast majority of workers in the country don't have anything like that. Most workers don't have any union at all. And we see now that to the boss, we're all expendable, even if we're quote-unquote essential for the moment. And it's been a disaster. One of the three major parts of the economy or parts of the country where we're seeing clusters is meatpacking plants, because these companies were set up to work workers as quickly as possible and treated them as much as the animals that they're tearing apart. And people are getting sick at these rapid rates to the point where the plants are getting shut down. And I think we're going to have real serious meat shortages in a couple of weeks.
Well, and you have Trump ordering them back, saying that they're essential. The companies claim they're making some changes, but you really have to wonder how much they really care about their workers.
Well, Trump is not ordering them back. I mean, this is a problem with Trump always, is that he's convinced himself of his own powers. He doesn't have the power to order anybody to work except for, I guess, the Secret Service and the military. What he's doing, though, is he is rolling back regulations that were preventing employers from forcing their employees back to work. So it is the bosses who are requiring workers to come back. And it is largely Republican politicians, not just Trump, but also a bunch of Republican governors, who are trying to cut off unemployment benefits and Medicaid eligibility for workers who refuse to work in these unsafe conditions. Trump is a boss, but he's not the boss that he thinks he is. There's OSHA and other workplace safety protections. There was the CDC and the Department of Health also sort of weighing in about what is a safe environment to be working in at this time. And so what Trump is trying to do is to say, ignore those regulations. I'm considering meatpacking essential, because God forbid Americans are denied their hamburgers for a week or two. And therefore now the employers are free to say, if you don't show up to work, you're fired. And by the way, we'll contest your unemployment insurance. That's the hammer that is forcing workers to make these really awful choices.
Yeah, and that's the thing, threatening to take away those protections from the employees. That's something that, you know, I'm not really hearing about this in the media.
I mean, the media is pretty terrible about covering actual working class issues. They have a caricature of the working class, and it's generally some guy in a hunting cap in Michigan, and he's white. Whereas the real working class are people who are on the front lines of this pandemic, people who are essential. I feel like, you know, a dark, bitter joke that's going to come out of this is that what's the definition of essential? Are you black, brown, woman, and without a union? Then, yeah, I guess you're an essential worker. I mean, and a problem that we have in this country, and one of the things that sort of inspired my book here, is that workers' rights have become a partisan issue in the worst possible way. That when Republicans are in power, they just attack workers' rights. I mean, they spend the years out of power coming with their laundry list of new ways to repeal the 20th century. Whereas too many Democratic decision makers, they're in a weird in a weird position, sort of treating the labor movement as either this nostalgic thing or as this handful of presidents in Washington that they need to make happy, where I think the opportunity of the moment, and again, one of the reasons I wrote this book, is that labor law reform is possible in a crisis. And we're in the crisis. And I wrote this in my book before we were in this particular awful crisis. But I think that the current pandemic scare and the economic meltdown that is going to result from it really lays bare that our system was just not working for most people, for most workers and most workers or most people. And that if we don't want to be caught in this awful cycle of right-wing Republicans peeling back any protections that we have, of our living standards continuing to decline, and brief moments of Democrats having enough power to pass some things, then the next time Democrats have the brief power to pass some things, I hope and I do think that enough of them recognize that they got to give the average worker more money, more power, more rights on the job so that we can organize unions and we can go on strike and we put the bosses on their heels and we can actually maybe stay in power for a couple more years than just the two that we've been managing to do.
And something really needs to happen. Since Trump's been in, they've been taking away protections from the environment and trying to force people to work in untenable conditions. Something needs to happen.
Something needs to happen. I think something is happening. I think that we are potentially in the midst of an historic strike wave, but it's impossible to capture because A, all the reporters are getting laid off, so they can't report on it. B, our government statistics on this aren't going to capture it because our Labor Department will only record strikes involving more than 1,000 workers at a time. And what's happening is McDonald's stores all over the country are going on strike, but it's 10 people at a time. So it doesn't get captured. But I think that you're having a lot of people who are put in this position of literal life and death, and they're pushing back on their bosses. And win, lose, or draw, they're learning some lessons about where their power is. When I wrote this book, this wasn't happening, obviously, but we were seeing a rather significant uptick in strike activity. 2019 was the high watermark for strikes in the United States in the 21st century. But I was really cautioning people that that was not a strike wave, because really all we did is we went back to 1986 levels of strikes. And 1986 was a pretty bad year for striking. The strike has been on this epic decline ever since Patco and Phelps Dodge and the whole 1980s union busting drive. You know, there's some paradoxical issues here. You know, we're not going to make substantial improvements in our working lives and in our society unless we are protesting on the job and we are taking the fight to the bosses. But we can't get that kind of strike activity without workers having seen a successful strike. And I define a successful strike as I went on strike, I inconvenienced my boss, and I returned to work the next day. That's what's happening right now. Workers are learning how to strike again, and I hope that we remember those lessons when we all get back to work so we can go back on strike.
Well, something that we did see was the teacher strikes. You had teachers and Republican states and so-called right-to-work states that were very visible. They were out there in the public, and Americans really supported them. That's different than anything I've seen in a while.
There's an instructive lesson in there about how strikes are contagious. The strike really came back for teachers' unions in the year 2012 when the Chicago teachers went on strike. People in my neck of the woods might be more familiar with this, where teachers' unions were strong. There was this charter school movement. There was all of these sort of either corporate Democrats or Republican mayors and governors who were trying to peel back the powers that unions had. They were trying to restrict collective bargaining rights. They put the teachers' unions back on their heels. So when the Chicago teachers went on strike, and I was at the national AFT at the time, there was a real feeling of like, is this too soon? Are people going to think that we're striking against the kids? But the CTU did a really great job of working with the community and working with parents so that the people of Chicago really saw that strike as their fight, and they won it. And if the Chicago teachers hadn't gone on strike, you never would have seen the West Virginia teachers go on strike. They totally got that idea from watching the Chicago teachers go on strike. And then slightly more amorphous or harder to measure, if SEIU hadn't started the fast food strikes, they hadn't started the Fight for 15 movement, and we saw these sort of one day of action strikes at McDonald's stores and Wendy's stores and Burger King stores, et cetera, I'm not sure that you would have gotten to the Chicago teachers strike. It just puts something electric into the air. it put the idea of going on strike on the table. It put the idea of where your source of power is in the back of the head of just enough workers that workers started talking to each other, started debating the issue, and started planning. So again, strikes are contagious. So whatever's happening right now in terms of the wildcat strikes that are happening during these pandemic conditions, I hope that it will lead to more workplace protests when things start up again in a real way.
Things are really precarious right now. People aren't working, a lot of them. They're at home. They're unable to pay their bills, and they're desperate to get back to work, even if it's putting them in a life-threatening position.
Yeah, I mean, that's exactly the case. I mean, strikes, I would say not to limit them to just workplace strikes, you know. I think that rent strikes and student debt strikes are also on the table, and it's very much the same sort of thing. The reason that the labor strike was on the decline is that the contagion can work in the opposite direction. And in the 1980s, you had too many examples of unions going on strike, and the employers finding enough permanent replacement workers, enough scabs to steal their jobs and vote the union out, that striking was seen as an ineffective strategy. And workers recoiled from it. You know, it's fashionable on the left to sort of say that union leaders abandoned it, but the reality is that that strikes terrified workers for a long, long time. They still scare the crap out of a lot of workers today, but they're much more on the table. You know, on a student debt strike, I mean, look, if you're unemployed, you know, if you're and you've got this crippling debt that you know you took out because everybody in a position of responsibility and authority said take out these loans, it's a good investment in yourself, it'll get you have guaranteed employment after this, and now you've got a $200, a $300, a $500 bill coming due every month, and you don't have the money because there is no work. Why would that's an illegitimate debt? Why would you pay it? Well, the reason you would pay it is that you're terrified that they're going to garnish your wages. They're going to destroy your credit. And it's one of these things where, just like a labor strike, there's the power in the numbers, but people sort of need to see a positive example of striking and winning, which is to say, I'm not going to pay my student loans for a while, and they're not going to take my house away from me, or they're not going to, you know, they're not going to take my, you know, they're not going to get access to my bank account and take my money. And I think those conversations are also, I mean, they are happening. I know they're happening. That's what it's going to come down to. You can't demand money out of people that aren't earning money because there's no ability to earn money. Meanwhile, you know, what, you've got the six richest people in the country, each made like an extra $1 billion. We're about to have our first trillionaire get coined in the middle of everybody else going poor during this economic and health disaster that was wrought by the fact that that trillionaire doesn't want to pay his taxes. I'm talking about Jeff Bezos, of course.
Well, and we had all these cuts for the wealthy. I mean, just was a couple of years ago that they pushed through this huge tax cut for the wealthy, and it was like they were just throwing money at them. And they were
inventing money. They were swishing it into existence. I mean, because all it was is we just added it to the national debt, which is fine. I mean, but the amazing thing about the Trump tax cut is that it proved this modern monetary theory that a lot of progressives have been pushing, that the government debt is not an issue. It's not a problem. If it's not raising inflation rates, somebody's still buying that debt, then all that is a credit card that you just have to pay the minimum payments on. And so the whole how do you pay for it debate within the Democratic primaries about, you know, Medicare for all or free college, the Republicans proved it by giving themselves $1.5 trillion just to shove up their noses. Inflation didn't go up. It also had no effect on the economy whatsoever. The economy didn't get stronger. It didn't trickle down to the rest of us. And now these bailout packages that are connected to COVID are also swishing trillions of dollars into the economy in each round. It's not causing tremendous inflation. Wall Street seems to be doing great. We could easily swish a couple trillion dollars into the economy to guarantee us all health care, wipe away the student debt, guarantee everybody free housing. And I hope that it's really exposing that to more people that aren't crazy radicals like me and the people that I hope will read my book. A tremendous lot more is possible. We're a victim of this billionaire class that's trying to scare us into the fact that we need them, when in fact it's they who need us, and our own lack of imagination about, you know, how the economy works in reality.
And that's just it. A lot of us don't really understand what's going on because we're getting all this push from the powerful telling us trickle-down economics and that unions are bad and all this other stuff. And there really isn't hardly any, if any, voices in the corporate media countering that.
Yeah, but, you know, I mean, 200,000 workers going on strike would speak louder than Matt Lauer. It would change the media narrative. I do think it all really does come down to our workplace rights and our power as workers being derived from the work that we do and our occasional refusal to do it. And, you know, that is, it's in a bit of a dialectic with the law. And this is a point that I try to make in the book. There's this story that we tell ourselves as progressives sometimes that can be disempowering, that the law won't change without the protest activity, without the strike wave, without the sit-down strikes. It's not entirely true, because the law changed before the sit-down strikes in the 1930s. We tend to think of the New Deal as happening all at once, and it didn't. There were actually two different waves of New Deal legislation. Franklin Roosevelt came into office. You and I probably would have hated him when he came into the office. He's this rich guy, and he wanted to prop up businesses. He wanted to figure out a way that businesses could engage in monopolistic practices and do price fixing and stop a sort of a race to the bottom on prices and wages. But in the course of that, he threw a sop to a very tiny and weak labor movement, a labor movement that is very analogous to the labor movement that we have today. There was a sentence inserted into the National Industrial Recovery Act that said, you know, you have a right to organize a union. There was no enforcement mechanism to it. It wasn't worth the paper it was written on. It raised enough workers' hopes that they actually started organizing, but employers continued to fire and blacklist and form company unions. But the workers were organizing because it was enough of a signal, there was enough of a promise there, and it actually sparked a strike wave in the year 1934. And the law that we now think of as our main labor law in this country, the National Labor Relations Act, that's passed in 1935. And I don't think you would get it without the strike wave. And even when it was passed, there was a fear that a very conservative Supreme Court, not unlike our current Supreme Court, would rule it unconstitutional. But they didn't, because the sit-down strikes started. And the sit-down strikes wouldn't have started without the strike wave in 1934. And so there's an opportunity in this moment of crisis. We're not quite strong enough to get an epic strike wave or to start the sit-down strikes, although I think we should be talking about how to do that. And I've got some thoughts of that in my book. But we are in enough of a crisis that if we can get a new president, if we can flip enough seats in the Senate, we can win something. And it won't be enough, but it might be enough to get the real protest activity going that we need to win what we deserve.
What about Joe Biden?
What about him?
Well, he's made a little noise about it, how he supports workers. But give us your thoughts.
I got to say, I had more optimism when I was writing this book because we had a lot of really good candidates in the race with a lot of really good labor platforms. I felt this weird feeling of watching things that I'm suggesting in this book that I'm like, oh, this is too crazy. It just wind up in, Beto O'Rourke's labor platform. I don't quite have the same optimism about Joe Biden, to be perfectly honest. So I do think that we're still in a moment where we need to go on strike. We need to put pressure on the bosses and on him to do what's necessary. Obviously, I think that a Biden presidency would be better than a Trump presidency. I'd sort of prefer an entirely different candidate I would have more confidence could win. And Biden is supporting, and I said this throughout the primary race, that the current labor law reform that the congressional Democrats have is this thing called the PRO Act. And it would mostly repeal Taft-Hartley. It would allow workers to engage in solidarity activism again, which is really the thing that killed us. Right to work isn't what killed us. What killed us is a lack of the ability to take an industrial dispute with your employer to another boss who has an intimate business relationship with them. Just solidarity. When Nabisco sent the Oreo factory out of Chicago, where it was unionized, and down to Mexico, it would have been great if unionized supermarket workers were able to say, we're not going to touch Oreo cookies. We're not going to unload them from the trucks. We're not going to put them on the shelves. We're not going to ring them up at our registers. But that would be totally illegal for them to do that, and Nabisco could sue the United Food and Commercial Workers for three times the economic damages that they would claim, and they would claim billions. That would just destroy the union. Meanwhile, there's no equivalent of a rule against employers from breaking labor law. So the PRO Act would repeal that. And that could actually do a lot in terms of restoring the power of workers. But in the context of the primaries, when you had Bernie Sanders supporting a just cause law, which is a thing that I've been advocating for, when you had Elizabeth Warren talking industry-wide sectoral bargaining as a law, you had people raising the idea of works councils, when you had all these candidates racing to say, yes, the PRO Act, but also these other important things, suddenly, if all you support is the PRO Act, then that's not good enough. That's actually a bad labor platform. And Joe Biden, along with Amy Klobuchar, were the two candidates who did the bare minimum, which to me is a real signal of I'm taking you for granted. So it's regrettable that the worst candidate for labor, in a lot of respects, is now the presumptive nominee. But more is possible in a Democratic administration, and hope one that is scared out of its mind over how ugly things have gotten in this country and how ugly they could be again if we don't make real substantial improvements for workers before the 2022 midterm elections. But don't count on any promises for Joe Biden. Let's actually plan to make threats against him. that's how we're going to make change in this country. And the reality of it all is also that if we somehow magically had a Bernie Sanders administration, he couldn't get it done without us all going on strike also. So, if I'm going to be a glass half full optimist, maybe it's better to have a president that we don't count on to do the job for us so that we're better prepared mentally for the fact that we're going to have to fight for everything that we're going to win.
We're in a position right now with Trump that we're not going to get anything. So at least Biden might be someone who could be pressured into doing something.
He's somebody who could be pressured into doing something. My greatest concern about him is I'm not sure he can win because he's about as inspiring as a clump of dirt. you have to make a few promises to the voters. I'm getting really tired of seeing all of these surrogates, write op-eds about how progressive his administration's going to be. I just want him to go out there and tell me that he gives a crap about me. I'm not hearing it, and that's scary because the election is going to come down to turnout. Trump does not enjoy majority support in this country, but we still have to outvote his supporters.
Biden is not inspiring. He makes all kinds of gaffes. Certainly not the candidate that most of us would have wanted.
Not that anybody's asking for my endorsement. That's basically the endorsement he's earned from me. I'll vote for him because I don't think we could survive another 4 years of Trump. But I'd like him to actually go out there and try to convince people that he deserves their vote.
What is some of the things that you would like to see happen in order to turn around where we are now?
Well, so if we keep it focused to labor, which is where my book is at, PRO Act doesn't go far enough. And in fact, reforming the National Labor Relations Act is not good enough. Although, if we're going to reform it, I've got a whole chapter in there about really where we need to fix it. And where we really need to fix it is we need to try to get the courts out of the law. We need a whole section of that amended National Labor Relations Act that basically tells the courts, you're wrong, you're always wrong, and just invalidates every bad court decision and says, stay out. But what we really need is a sort of an all-in system of labor relations. The problem with the National Labor Relations Act is that it's on a workplace-by-workplace basis, and these are really high-stakes elections. And even if you turn it into card check, it's still a really high-stakes election, and employers, they're going to fight like hell, and they're going to secede from the system, as they've been doing since 1970. They're going to offshore, they're going to subcontract, they're going to freelance. And so we need something that says, regardless of what your employment status is, regardless of who signs your paycheck, we're going to set rules that apply to your entire industry. And so that's where I like the idea of works councils, sort of a German model of separating the union from, right now, a union in America plays both the role of government and political party. And it's this all or nothing proposition. When we're going to vote in November, we're not voting for whether there's going to be a Congress. There's going to be a Congress. We're just voting for whether my congressman is going to be a Republican or a Democrat. When a union is on the ballot line, you're voting for whether there's going to be any government at all or whether the boss can be a dictator. That shouldn't be an election. There should be a government on day one as a matter of law, and then which union you join is up to you. So I think we need systems like that. I'm a big supporter of a just cause, a right to employment. Right now, most workers in this country, most non-union workers certainly, operate under what's called at-will employment, which is basically, if you don't like the terms of employment, if you don't like your wages, if you don't like your boss telling you to come in on Sunday during a pandemic, you're free to quit. But he's also free to fire you anytime. And that fear of termination is killing us. Fear is one of the major things that drives back union organizing drives. And so if every worker in this country, on day one, regardless of your status, regardless of whether there's a union, regardless of whether you're a teacher or not, if you enjoyed a right to your job, that you can only be fired for a good performance-based job-related reason, and you had the ability to challenge that termination, that the employer had to make a positive case that you deserve termination, I think that would be a real game changer in terms of people's ability and willingness to say no to unreasonable demands, you know, to say no to Matt Lauer. I'm not going to come up to your hotel room, you know, to say no. I'm not going to pick up your dry cleaning. That's not in my job description. To say no, I'm not going to come in and work in this supermarket until you put plexiglass in front of the cash register.
And that's what workers need. They need to feel like they have some control and they're not just at the whim of their employer.
Right, and we don't have that. And even in unionized situations, the employer has way too much power. So we need laws that are going to sort of even the playing field and apply across the board. We have to take away the employer's ability to secede from the system. We need a sort of a sectoral bargaining or industry-wide rulemaking, whatever it is, that says it doesn't matter if you're working for the hotel itself or for a subcontracted call center for the hotel. These rules apply to you. This is the minimum wage for your industry. This is the level of benefits you're entitled to. These are the amount of hours that you're allowed to work for or say no to.
Let's talk about that for a little bit, because there is this drive to turn everybody, or as many people as they can, into subcontractors so that they owe you no benefits. You have no rights, really. Can you talk a bit about the push for that and, you know, and how people push back against that?
The push for it is entirely about seceding from the unionized system. You had very high union density in the early 1970s, and in the 1970s, manufacturers in particular started to feel global competition for the first time. I mean, it's funny, it's not what we actually sort of think of cheap Mexican labor, right? It's sort of, or cheap Chinese labor. It was Japan and Germany getting back on their feet after the World War. It was Volkswagens and Toyotas coming into this country. And A, they were a lot, unfortunately, in a lot of cases, they were better, more fuel-efficient cars. That's on the bosses. That's not on the workers. But they're also cheaper. And one of the reasons they were cheaper is that those employers don't pay the cost of health insurance, that those costs are artificially loaded onto the employer's payroll and rolled over onto consumers. A rational, reasonable thing would have been for a General Motors to join with the United Auto Workers and say, okay, it's time to expand Medicare because we don't want to pay for health insurance anymore. This should be a government thing. They didn't, because the reality is that bosses sort of like the power that they have over their workers in terms of controlling the health care and the access to doctors, and that you'll lose it if you get fired or you step out of line. And instead, they just started subcontracting and offshoring, and that's what it's entirely about. I don't want to be responsible on record for your being your employer, so that if you get COVID right now, because you had to work, you know, the office building that you're cleaning is not responsible for that. It's the janitorial firm that they hired. It's a fly-by-night company, and it could be replaced at any time. And so on and so on. There's all kinds of gig worker centers pushing back on this. But this is a thing that is going to be very hard to fix without a fix in the law. And it's just got to be one that sort of follows the money trail and says, we're going to go up 8 levels. You know, it doesn't matter if you're a subcontractor of a subcontractor or a subcontractor. McDonald's is the boss, and McDonald's is on the hook legally. And so these are the rules that McDonald's has to enforce up and down their supply chain.
In this country, so many people get their insurance through their employer, and now a lot of them have lost their insurance. When Bernie was in the race, you know, with this message of Medicare for all, that was something that was striking home, but now we're not hearing that anymore, and people are getting...
I'm hearing it.
Yeah, a bit.
I'm hearing it. My neighbors are talking about it. I mean, this is the battle that we have, right? I mean, and this is, what can I say? You know, as the Republican Party becomes a death cult, all of the health insurance executives have left it and have become Democrats. And so they're throwing their money around in the Democratic Party, and they're throwing their political weight around in the Democratic Party. And even though this is the ideal time to expand the Medicare system and get out of this sort of private health insurance, employer-based system, it's an obvious solution. In fact, every other solution is insane, given what we're facing. But all the pressure is on Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi to not do it, even though we're just going to, you know, we're going to invent $3 trillion more dollars in a couple of weeks, maybe. That could easily create the system. And it's because the health insurance executives have this great setup right now. If the Republicans win, they get paid. The rest of us are terrified of the Republicans winning. If the Democrats win, well, then they get to scare the Democratic leaders out of, don't do this or else you're going to lose our money, and then the Republicans will win. And it's a total trap that we're caught in. I'm not sure how they continue to win this game when you have 37, 40, 50 million people losing their health insurance because they lost their jobs. There's no amount of how do you pay for it scaremongering that the pundits on TV can do that can convince somebody who is terrified of getting this awful plague and simultaneously losing their ability to talk to their doctor to say, oh yeah, I love this system. I don't want to lose the ability to talk to my doctor. So I'm afraid of Medicare for all. The whole thing is nonsense at this point. My only fear about it is that it is such nonsense. I think we have a real problem, real threat of this moment is that people are going to succumb to just total cynicism. All levels of authority and professional judgment and everybody that we're told are the people who know, you know, the knowers, are just revealing themselves to either be liars, charlatans, or worse. And cynicism is a dangerous thing because Trump wins with cynicism. Cynicism makes you stay home and say, why vote? It only encourages them.
Can you wrap things up for us? We've got a few minutes left. What are your thoughts as we go out?
I mean, it's a really dark time. I mean, this is a very strange way to have an interview with you. I'd much rather be sitting in the studio with you in Houston. I can't wait till we all get back to work so that we can all start going on strike and tell the bosses that that's what they're looking forward to.
This fear that so many people have right now, getting over that and feeling confident that they can go on strike. Your thoughts there?
If people have jobs, because I think we're heading into a new Great Depression, so I think we're going to have too many people that are learning how to strike are not going to have jobs come November or January. But for the people who do have jobs, I think they're learning lessons that can't be unlearned. And so I think that the strike weapon is really back on the table in a real way. And that is one of the most encouraging things about this moment.
Well, Sean, thank you so much for being with us. I appreciate your time.
Thank you.
My guest has been Sean Richmond. He's author of the new book, Tell the Bosses We're Coming, A New Action Plan for Workers in the 21st Century. Stay tuned. Coming up next, we have my co-host, Lillian Kerr, with her segment, A Bird's